As the flow of new migrants has slowed, harvesting the nation's crops has been left to an aging population of farm workers, and their health has suffered from decades of hard labor.
The slowdown is happening. You could just see your production drop, but it's difficult to really manage because there's not the younger people aren't wanting to come in and work in this industry.
I'm Kelly McEvers. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen every afternoon at 4 on KTOO Juno at 104.3.
Tonight on 360 North at 8, KTOO reporters share and discuss recent stories examining poverty and opportunity in Alaska on Forum at 360, Chasing the Dream. At 9, American Forum examines the perils of our standoff with North Korea. This is America and the World follows at 9:30, Great Decisions in Foreign Policy at 10, and America's Now at 10:30. Tonight on 360 North and 360north.org.
Hello and welcome to this first Friday edition of A Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today on this Gallery Walk Day. Always a festive day to be downtown in Juneau, Alaska. Today is no different. And even right here in the studios of KTOO, there's a wonderful art exhibit happening. So come on down if you're listening. Sally Smith's going to be here today to highlight this year's Holiday Pops. We're going to be talking to Lily Hope about a new generation of weavers. Michelle Hale will be here to talk about her father, Herb Bonet's art sale. And we'll talk with India Young and Suzanne Frick about the As We See It exhibit at the APK building. Also, Chris Taylor, photographer, will be here to talk about the exhibit happening here at KTOO. That's all coming up right after National Native News here on Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribes, including the Navajo Nation and environmental groups, are set to take legal action over any changes to Bears Ears National Monument in Utah, which tribes consider sacred. President Trump is expected to travel to Utah next week and announce plans on Bears Ears. Maps obtained this week by news organizations and the Native American Rights Fund show the administration's plan, which tribal leaders and attorneys say will drastically diminish Bears Ears. In a statement, Navajo Nation President Russell Begay said the tribe fought for the creation of the monument, adding any action to diminish Bears Ears will be an action against the tribe and people who work for its protection. The Native American Rights Fund is representing the Hopi, Zuni, and Ute Mountain Ute tribes. Native American Rights Fund attorney Natalie Landreth says the move on Bears Ears and another Utah monument is illegal, saying only Congress can revoke monument protections.
This unprecedented decision, and I don't say that lightly, we mean it. This is not like anything we have ever before seen in any of the other presidential situations, because this is a full-scale revoke and replace. It creates two different monuments with two different names, two different boundaries, and different maps. This is not, no matter what they want to call it, a boundary modification.
Landreth joined the Navajo Nation, New Mexico U.S. Senator Tom Udall, and environmental groups on a press call Friday morning to object to the administration's plans. Attorneys declined to provide details of their lawsuits, saying they're waiting for executive action to take place and will then follow it with legal action. President Obama proclaimed the more than 1 million acres Bears Ears National Monument in 2016. In April, President Trump ordered the Interior Department to review a number of national monuments, including Bears Ears. Tribal leaders and attorneys say the Trump administration's plan to shrink Bears Ears is being done without tribal consultation. A community healing walk is planned Saturday on the Bad River Reservation in Wisconsin for a teenager who was shot and killed by an officer in November. Family, friends, and community members say the walk is to remember Jason Pirro. They say the event is to share Jason's message to show who he was, which they say was a loving, caring boy who is also knowledgeable of his culture. His family and tribe dispute a preliminary investigation into the incident and have asked for a federal investigation. Investigators say Pirro lunged at an Ashland County Sheriff's deputy with a butcher knife before being shot twice. Investigators say a search of the 14-year-old's bedroom showed he was despondent days leading up to the incident. The tribal council believes the deputy used excessive force and says they're taking a stand for justice. Saturday's event will include a youth-led honor song and student message. Organizers say the incident has impacted the entire community, and the event is to help the community come together and heal. A ribbon cutting was held Thursday for a new eatery in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The Laguna Burger Restaurant is a business venture of the Laguna Pueblo. The tribe's main generator of revenue is in the hospitality industry. Skip Sayer is with the Laguna Development Corporation.
We've grown the business tremendously on the Pueblo itself, and now for the first time we're venturing outside of the reservation to expand our business and increase our revenue-generating capabilities for our shareholders, which are the members of the Pueblo.
The new Laguna Burger occupies about 3,000 square feet near Old Town, creates more than two dozen jobs, features an expanded menu of hamburgers, hot dogs, and salads, and a full bar. The tribe already operates 11 restaurants, casinos, and two travel centers on I-40. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills, with rewarding service opportunities around the country and info at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista. Support by AARP, creating and connecting you to unique tools and content like Native Origins, incorporating Native American culture with recipes inspired by indigenous foods. More at AARP.org/Native Origins.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
KTOO is gearing up to launch the on-air portion of our Winter Member Drive on December 5th. But you can get a head start on your giving and have a chance to win one of three Eagle Crest season passes. You are automatically entered to win by making your donation now at KTOO.org, or you can also enter without a donation. This opportunity ends at 5 p.m. Monday, December 4th. Make your contribution now and enter for your chance to win an Eagle Crest season pass at KTOO.org.
And welcome back to a Juno Afternoon. I'm here joined by my friend Sally Smith. Sally, thanks so much for joining us.
Andy, it's fun to be with you again.
Yeah, and always something different to talk to you about whenever you come on. But today we're going to be talking about a really fun event that you were saying has been going on. This is the 10th year, and it's something that, even though it's been going on for 10 years, maybe not a lot of people know about it in a way.
I don't think they do.
Yeah, so it's the Holiday Pops concert.
Holiday Pops, and it's not a normally organized group.
Okay.
No, we just
say, in different ways.
Anybody who wants to sing, come join us. There are no auditions. There are no fees to sing. And this year, we had over 90 people come try this on. I think there'll be about 75 or 76 on the risers.
Wow.
As a chorus.
So, and those are people strictly singing. And then there's also musicians involved, right?
Everything. Half an hour before the concert starts, we're just honored to have the Capitol Brass Quintet. They've been with us 4 years, and we've had brass for 10. But as you come in the doors, a half an hour before the concert, the main concert begins, the Capitol Brass will be in concert for your enjoyment. The playing holiday music with brass is just the season, isn't it?
Right.
The lights and the brass. And then as we get into the concert, we're going to have a little presentation by the Advanced Orchestra from Floyd Dryden Junior High, which should be really nice, too. That group is going to join the chorus and accompany us on a piece in the second half of the concert, which will be followed by a new string quartet accompanying us. Each of them is a member of the Juno Symphony. So that should be pretty special as well, chorus and string quartet. Sarah Radke Brown is going to play a solo, or sing a solo.
Right.
She doesn't play. She sings, and she's wonderful. She's going to sing Ave Maria. And then we're going to be joined by the brass accompanying us on Joy to the World, and then we have a new Christmas fanfare with them. So it's about 100 different people from the community who come together.
Yeah.
They're everyone, and I want to mention, too, Lori Hagee and Missouri Smythe are accompanying us. You don't get any better than that. Everyone is donating their time to make this happen, so the ticket prices are only $10.
This seems like almost impossible. You know what I mean? You've got 100 people involved. It's only $10. You do two different venues, right?
We do
so you're doing
two different venues.
One out at the University Library and then one back at the Jack,
That's
right. How long does it take you to start setting up to get it organized, to get it going? And
we started rehearsals at the end of October.
Okay.
And we are under the sponsorship of the Juno Arts and Humanities Council, who are just wonderful about all the logistics of location. So some of our rehearsals have been at the Jack, and other rehearsals have been through community schools out at Glacier Valley. We try to divide our energies between both downtown and the valley so that no one group has to do all the traveling, and that no one group feels they have to do all the driving to attend a concert.
Right, but you need a venue that has a big parking lot.
In both places.
A lot of people
involved. And the Arts and Humanities Council will be taking the risers out to the university library.
Okay.
Then they'll tear them down and bring them back down to the Jack and set up in the Jack for us.
Wow, and this is mid-month, 16th and 17th, is that right?
We're going to do the 16th out at the university in the library, a beautiful setting with all those windows. If it snows, it's even more magical than before. The concert for that night is a Saturday night. The concert starts at 7:30. It will probably run about an hour and a half, maybe depending on how long people take for intermission.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, the brass starts a half an hour before. So the brass will start at 7. The concert will start at 7:30. On Sunday, we move back downtown to the Jack, and the pre-concert will start at 3:30 when the doors open, and then the chorus starts at 4 o'clock.
Wow, and you say this has been happening for 10 years, right?
10 years.
When it started, how many people were involved? Was it a big number of people right from the start? Popular
48.
Yeah, so still, big.
Yeah.
And then it kind of grows and grows, but you have to, at some point, I'm sure you have to sort of say, okay, whoa, let's slow our roll here.
No, so far we haven't. It's just really been amazing. There's been a turnover. Not everybody can do things every year. They have different jobs. They move away from town. And the beauty of the whole thing is people coming together to meet one another. It isn't the same group every year. Now, there are some who have been with us the whole 10 years. But mostly, there's this new fusion of friendships and camaraderie and, of course, the goal of getting to a finished product to present a concert from people that this isn't their job.
Yeah. So what was happening 10 years ago? What was the spark that started this? Or
Juno Lyric Opera asked me what I would do if I could do something at the holiday season. And I said, well, you know, nobody really has accessible, I shouldn't say accessible. All music is accessible. It's different tastes. But no one had ever was presenting holiday music of the pop genre.
Well, I mean, that pops tradition, I grew up in the Boston area. Of course, the Boston Pops are, you know, renowned for that, and was always very approachable music, especially young people, all kinds of people.
Right.
That's how I got introduced into what an orchestra was, what
there
a symphony was, you know, because it was fun music in that kind of genre of having a lot of fun, not overly serious.
And we're going to start with Have Yourselves a Merry Little Christmas,
sure,
which is a medley of five different popular holiday songs, seasonal, not religious. So the first half is pretty much seasonal music, and then including Twas the Night Before Christmas. Then in the second half, we move to the sacred, and that would be more along the serious music that people might remember from singing in high school.
Yeah, sure. But that's such a nice mix, you know, to be able to say, well, this is the fun stuff, and this is what you heard Bing Crosby saying, and that kind of stuff. And then now this is the maybe more, you know, like what you quote-unquote serious music.
Right.
Yeah, right, right.
It certainly moves in that direction. Ave Maria comes from that set, and Oh Holy Night, which is the piece we'll do with the kids from Floyd Dryden. And then we have a beautiful setting of See Amid the Winter Snow. It's just ethereal. That's the one that will be done with the string quartet. But then we finish off with the brass. So
okay, yeah. So you just pump it back up. Right?
Absolutely. Right. And as they say, 100 people, a lot of them didn't know each other before this process started. And they come out achieving a goal together. And, of course, it makes new business relationships. It makes new friendships. And it's a gift that we give to the community by pooling the talent.
Yeah.
That we have.
Is it kind of a, what are the age variations?
I have some.
Not to call anyone out specifically here. But,
well,
yeah.
Again, it varies from year to year, but
yeah.
I have some younger people this year than I've had in past years. Of course, the junior high kids.
Sure, yeah.
But they come
right.
in a group. And the chorus probably ranges somewhere from the early 30s up through... I'm up there.
Okay, sure. Okay, we'll leave it at that.
There are a couple
Let's
people that are in that bracket.
That's that general range. And men and women? And
men and women. Kind of it's a four-part, sometimes eight-part harmony.
So does it go from baritone to soprano?
Bass.
Okay.
Soprano.
All right. So that's this full range.
It's the full range.
Yeah, that's exciting.
It is choral music,
yeah.
And rare for me anymore. At our rehearsal Tuesday night, I actually got that chill that comes over you, the goosebumps that when something is really, really good.
Sure. The back
and
of the neck
yeah,
little bit thing.
And they
yeah, right.
Get it. I could tear up on a,
yeah.
in a few spots.
Yeah.
So we have a couple more weeks of rehearsal, then we're on. And I think by then it's going to be one of those things you remember that you shared with your family.
As you said, you were telling me that it usually sells out. So how do people get tickets?
They can get their tickets online at jahc.org. Or they can go to the Jack and pick them up right there at the ticket counter or the bookstores.
And as you said, only $10. It's
only $10.
A little bargain for a night of beautiful music.
And community connection. No professionals in this. I mean, we've been trained professionally maybe, but we are not presenting ourselves as professionals. We're presenting ourselves as coming together as a community to share the season, regardless of anybody's background or beliefs. To just have a nice time as people in Juneau sharing
well, it's
the
a
season.
Great embodiment of the holiday spirit.
That's what we hope.
Yeah. Sally Smith, thanks so much for coming in and telling us about it. It's the Holiday Pops. It's happening on the 16th and 17th. The 16th is out at UAS at the library. The 17th is here at the Jack. Tickets are $10. They're available at jahc.org. And it's going to be a wonderful couple of evenings, I'm sure.
Thank you,
Sally,
Andy.
Thanks
and
so
thanks
much.
To K2 for
yeah.
this service.
Yeah, thanks for coming in.
Yeah.
Welcome back to a Juno Afternoon and this beginning of the holiday season here on December 1st. And Gallery Walk is happening. It's a time when we all start thinking maybe as much as we normally should think about the arts, about what it brings to our community. And I'm here to talk about one of the most amazing types of art that this area of the world brings to everyone is Lily Hope, to talk about weaving and a new generation of weavers.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, yeah, and Deanna Lampe is also here to hold the paper that Lily refers to while Lily holds her daughter, Anastasia Clarissa, who is here.
She'll be quiet, I swear.
She's nice and quiet and being comforted there.
The baby or me?
Yeah.
Yes. Who's? So let's talk about this. Your mother, obviously, one of the famous weavers who unfortunately passed away recently, and I'm very sorry to hear about that.
Thank you.
But to continue on with this work and this kind of artwork that is so unique to this area. So tell me about this idea of new generation of weavers.
So both Jenny Flanott, my mother's teacher, and Clarissa Rizal were both committed to perpetuating Chilkat weaving into the future, and that was a commitment that my mother made to her teacher. So I didn't realize that I made that commitment to my mother as well, and here I am. So I've kind of led this workshop for the past 4 months called Descendants of the Masters, and it's funded by the Alaska State Council on the Arts, and it was part of an art shops grant. They do 4 or 5 of those a summer, and we have to wrap it up by the 31st of December, so it's perfect timing.
Okay, so there you go. Right,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So here we are. So we've been gathering 2 or 3 or 4 times a month, sometimes more, but about 3 times a month together, 26 of us all together, you know, varying numbers in there, but working on these Chilkat faces, which is the central, like, human shape in a Chilkat robe, and some of the most complex shapes that you can weave in a Chilkat blanket.
Right, because it's, you're really trying to capture a character, right? And
sure.
So it's maybe more than geometric shapes or things like that. It's,
and there are so many moving braids that are happening in between everything. And Auntie Deanna is nodding over here.
Yes.
Going, oh, it's so much to think about.
Yeah.
Much more than, you know, a line of beads. But there, it's organized chaos.
When you said something that's interesting to me, which is that when your mother passed away, you realized you had this responsibility to continue on this tradition. Was it something you had interest in before? I know you as a performance artist, but I didn't know that you were necessarily a weaver. But is it something you had always kind of done, or?
I've been doing handiwork and weaving for the past, I guess, 7 years, and I found that I enjoyed teaching. I would say if I could be like 70% teaching, 30% weaving, that's kind of the ratio I'd go for.
Mm-hmm.
So I taught a few classes with my mother, and during that time she said, gee, Lily, you're a pretty decent teacher.
She's a very good teacher.
I can imagine, yeah.
And I'm like a class and a semester of student teaching away from a master's in teaching.
Okay.
And so I was like, well, do I teach weaving or do I get this degree or what do I do? So that's still up in the air. I have a couple more weeks to figure out whether I'm going to finish that or not.
Okay.
But the teaching of weaving is natural to me, and it brings joy to my life. So,
is the work of the new weaver something that people can observe, or is there so tell me about that, if there's a way to look at it, or is there a goal for when that could be displayed? Or
so this show that we're having at the Jack, that's
okay.
What's happening tonight.
Oh,
is the first,
so there you go. Sorry.
Yeah. Yes.
See,
yeah.
I'm not informed. There's a coincidentally, yeah. There's a show tonight.
So tonight,
the rest of the month. Yeah.
It is unique in that we have it frozen in time, exactly where we stopped in the workshop. So you can see the very beginning of a piece. You can see them with eyebrows. You can see them with eyes shaped and frozen without a nose. Then we have the noses in, and then we have finished faces. So if there's someone who's excited about Chilkat weaving, or you don't know you're excited, you're going to come in and say, wait a minute, mm-hmm. Look at how these are constructed.
So tell me a little bit about that. I know that they're this incredibly complex way of weaving. I know they incorporate some organic materials and things like that. So tell me a little bit about some of that technique.
We take mountain goat hair or merino wool and twine it on our thigh, spin it on our thigh with cedar bark in it, a little dental floss, thin strips of that. And that becomes our warp that hangs freely from a frame.
Oh, strips of cedar bark, sort of like long tailing strips of, okay.
preferably long.
I see.
Have to spin it with teeny tiny pieces, it takes you a lot longer.
And that's yellow cedar?
Yes, preferably,
right.
Sometimes red.
Okay,
Depends on what you have available
right
here.
Right, and there's not a lot of yellow cedar growing all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
So then we take that as our base, and we will weave over that with fingering weight or sock weight merino wool yarns, sometimes mountain goat hair yarns for the very ambitious who want to process all that. And it's beautiful. And so we finger twine it because there are no shuttles involved. All of the twining happens with just our hands. All the tension and all the shapes are created with our fingers only.
And then the dyes, that very characteristic yellow and aqua, those and black, those dyes, how are those incorporated?
Those are the traditional colors on top of natural.
Are there natural dyes that are used?
There are natural dyes. Am I allowed to tell what they are?
Oh, of course.
Oh, so they're made out of urine, if you can tell. So the yellow is a base of urine with some wolf moss. And the wolf moss we have to go exchange with our relatives because we don't have wolf moss around here.
Yeah.
Witch's beard doesn't work.
Okay.
But then to make the blue, we also start with a base of urine. And unfortunately, I didn't save my pregnant woman urine because that is the most powerful. It has the strongest
is it
ammonia.
Acidic or?
It's very, very ammonia. Strong ammonia.
And
that's where you're going to get a beautiful blue when you drop copper into your strong urine. And
that's fascinating.
Right? So
the
patina effect is what, like, you know, you get it agitated, and you want to let that bucket sit for 3 or 4 months before you dunk your yarns in there.
Wow, that is a really fascinating thing.
Maybe you should say that the yellow wool in these pieces were not dyed.
Yes.
Yeah, these were not done that way?
Yeah, right.
Okay. These were synthetic dyes.
We don't want anybody getting
the heebie-jeebies.
But I mean, it just makes so much sense that you use the materials that are available to you. They're going to be all, this is such a long-standing tradition that obviously it's going to be all organic materials that are around. And this is fascinating to know how that happened. And also the fact that it is, you know, it's indelible, right? I mean, it's permanent. And and that permanency is an interesting thing, too, because so many organic dyes seem to have this, can have this thing of they fade so easily.
Well, they
so
do.
Easily.
That
yeah.
is the interesting thing is that I just finished a robe in May, and when I was dyeing yarns for it a year and a half ago, I said, hey, Mama, what am I going to do here? Do I use the natural dyes or synthetic dyes? And she said, well, do you want your dyes to be yellow in 300 years, or do you want them to be white? And so I chose the synthetic dyes for my first robe, but I'm on the road to using some natural dyes, and I'm pretty excited about weaving those.
Right.
When you see that in 400 years, you're gonna be, you know.
Yeah, I'm gonna want it to be white in 400.
Exactly.
When I come back and see them.
Yes. Right. And then so you described the kind of materials, how it goes, and then the actual weaving process itself, is it a loom, and how is that kind of?
So when people think about weaving, they probably think that there's tension on both sides of the warp that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't that happening in Chilkat weaving. And the warp hangs vertically downward towards the ground, and we don't have anything fastening at the bottom. So there's no tension except what we can create with our hands.
Oh,
so every single twine is controlled.
So it's literally just hung kind of on one, and then it's pulled and twined
over. Mm-hmm.
Wow, and so to get a really tight weave on it must take incredible skill, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's something that
patience,
some ridiculous time, and a little bit of neuroses and
right.
In these pieces, how many warps are probably hanging down? 30?
There are 12 times. There's 120 warps hanging on most of these.
120 warps hanging, and then you've got all these weavers and wefts and braids.
Traveling.
And,
it
gets a little up there.
Yeah.
So to get from one side to the other, you're going to have to make 60 stitches, twining them over, under, these two strands moving across the warp.
So to do one of these, you know, what we in our mind think of, that's a beautiful museum piece, Chilkat blanket, is this years in the making? Is it
the fastest weaver I know can weave one in a year?
1 year.
Jenny Xanat, who is not my mother but my mother's teacher, she could do it in 6 months. I don't know what she was, because she was also working the laundry and taking care of her kids and cooking meals, and she would get up at 3 a.m. and weave until 6 and make breakfast and send her kids out and go to work all day and come back and weave for a couple hours after dinner. She was wild.
Yeah.
But it did take me 17 months to finish my first Chilkat blanket. These faces, some weavers have spent 50 hours weaving them, and we have eyebrows done. Some weavers have spent 100 hours, and they have a finished face. So there is definitely a range of skill, which is, we love that. We've had 7 experienced weavers and about 20 newbies, some of them with no weaving experience at all, and some who've only done Ravenstall weaving, which is the geometric textile that we do in the Northwest Coast. So it's been really fabulous to be together and to learn from each other.
Yeah, and so and the way that you described how the how it hangs, what was the term, I'm sorry, that you used for how it hangs down?
The warp hangs.
The warp hangs. Yeah. So the warp, is it that traditional shape, that kind of chevron shape of Chilkat blankets, is it a result of the way that warp hangs, or is that just a design element that's specifically...
The way that a Chilkat blanket curves at the bottom?
Yeah, yeah.
You do that.
You do that specifically.
The warp is the wool that's hanging down.
Okay.
But if you look closely at a Chilkat robe, that warp hanging down on a Chilkat robe is going to be tapered or staggered so that it is shorter on the outer edges, and then it gets longer as that border comes down.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah,
okay. Mm-hmm. Really,
so
yeah.
We have these fancy warp sticks that have measurements for us with notches in them, and we can measure them how we want them to be.
Yeah. Do you want to mention the people who are showing their work tonight?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, and I've got the list.
Okay.
Crystal Nelson, Deborah Ogara, myself, Karen Togg, Kelsey Erickson-Kaiser, Lane Reinhart, Mary Marks, Nyla Reinhart, Anastasia Hobson, Pam Credo-Hayes, Davina Drones, Selena Beerley, Katie Pittman, Kay Parker, Patty Fiorella, Leona Santiago, Maria Abbott, Marsha Hotch, Shken George, Ursula Hudson from Colorado, long distance, and Ricky Tagaban. Then there are also four other folks, women who took part in the workshop, but their weavings are not available. Mariah Twitchell, Della Cheney, Irene Lampe, and Tahona James.
Wow, that's quite a list of folks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this is happening at the Jack tonight from 4:30 to 7 with wonderful snacks, baklava. Come over and eat our baklava. And see these Chilkat faces frozen in time for you to check them out.
And how will this work continue? Is there a plan for how this is going to continue to grow and to keep going with this new generation of weavers that are hopefully being inspired right now by all this work?
So myself, I'm going to continue to hold space at least twice a month at the Artists of All Nations over at the Jack. That happens once a month. And then we've been doing a weaving/craft thing over at the Douglas Library once a month as well. So any weaver in this workshop or any other weaver who's interested can come find me during those two things. I'll be around, and I'm sure other weavers will be there too.
Great place to find you would be tonight at the Jack during the show. Come and meet Lily and... Mm-hmm. Let her know that you're interested and want
to
continue it. Yeah.
That this art shop or this show is supported as an art shop, supported by the National Endowment for the Arts, Alaska State Council on the Arts, and the Siri Foundation in partnership with the Alaska Arts and Culture Foundation. The Alaska Native Creative Leaders and the Art Shops program is administered by the Alaska State Council on the Arts.
Right.
Happy to say that.
Yes, that's great. We want to give credit where credit's due, right? Well, Lily and Deanna, thanks so much for coming in, letting us know about it. Thanks for the work you're doing to continue this beautiful artwork that your mother was so prominent in. And have a great show.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Thank you so much.
This is Bird Note. Have you ever watched ducks walking around in freezing temperatures and wondered how they keep their feet from freezing? The ducks seem oblivious to the cold, even as they stand on ice-covered lakes and streams. Or perhaps you've been concerned that the tiny feet of songbirds will freeze to metal perches. Unlike our feet, birds' feet are little more than bone, sinew, and scale, with very few nerves. But it takes more than a lack of nerves to keep their feet from freezing. An amazing adaptation called reti mirabili is responsible. The arteries that transport blood into the legs lie in contact with the veins that return blood to the bird's heart. The warm arteries heat the cooler veins. Because the veins also cool the arteries, the bird's feet are closer to environmental temperature, and thus don't lose as much heat as they would if they were at body temperature. And those little songbirds' feet? Don't worry. Birds' feet lack sweat glands and stay dry, so there's no danger of them freezing to metal perches. What was that called again? Riti Mirabili. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein. Support for BirdNote comes from Songbird Coffee, offering bird-friendly, organic, shade-grown coffee for holiday giving. More at birdnote.org/songbird.
The Juno Arts and Humanities Council and KTOO present art classes, monthly, not your typical sip and paint classes, the second Thursday of each month. And December's featured artist is Lorelei Miko. Craft a paper garden using paper as a creative and flexible material on December 14th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Rockwell. Think holiday centerpieces or most amazing gift for those you love. All supplies included, no host bar. Tickets at the Jack, K2, and JAHC.org.
And welcome back to a Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein with you here. And I'm joined by Kayla Wyatt and by Michelle Hale, whose father, Herb Bonnet, is a quintessential Southeast Alaska artist. When I asked, well, how would you describe the work? That was the first thing that came to mind. And you're having a show of his work and a pretty fun idea, a pop-up gallery that you've got over in the Marineway building down at 213 Ferry Way. So that's happening. We got to get you out of here because you got to get back down to the shop, right? Yeah, so we'll get you down there. But tell me a little bit about the idea behind this art show.
Well, I think the big idea for me is that Herb's legacy is not going to live on if I don't keep his prints getting out there. So that, in my mind, that's the best way for his legacy to live on. Mm-hmm. He passed away this year, and we put this together pretty quickly. It's a pop-up gallery, but it also came together very quickly. I've had some wonderful people helping me put it together. We're calling it Prints and Cards, Models and Memorabilia. And we rented this 700-square-foot space in the Marine View, and then basically downloaded his storage units into the space.
Okay.
And we have 123 models in kits that I can't vouch for because Herb had a tendency to take the models apart and pick one little thing and put it on something else, but they're there for very good deal, very good prices. And then we have a lot of his prints. We have cards. We have posters. That's a new thing, the cards and the posters. And
now, let me stop you for a minute because when you say prints, I get that. But when you say models, what is that?
So
what artwork was he doing?
So if you're familiar with Herb's work, he loved boats and planes. He painted boats and planes.
I see.
He painted a lot of old boats and planes. Like, he loved the Princess Louise, the Princess Kathleen, and then Army, Navy, you know, stuff used in wars. And so when we're talking models, it's that kind of model.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And we've got everything. We've got
very
go ahead.
Oh, at the show, there's also beautiful originals that are on display there also.
What were the years of his kind of primary years that he was working, and did he have different stages? Was he doing prints and paintings during kind of one active stage, then moved to models, or how did his career flow?
He was really probably very popular in the, 70s and 80s, would you say? But that was a real high peak art buying time.
Mm-hmm, sure, yeah, right. A lot of money flowing in Alaska back in pipeline days, yeah.
And he painted and drew his whole life. So he, for a period of time, worked as a draftsman at Boeing, and he also worked at the Ok Bay Lab as a draftsman or an artist. He would, you know, illustrate. He was an illustrator. He would mm-hmm. illustrate magazines and things like that. I think he made his living full-time as an artist probably since the early 60s.
Coming from that standpoint of being a draftsman, very precision work, did that carry over to his artwork, that precision nature, that kind of
attention
to detail?
Oh, I definitely think so, yeah. Yeah, he's very precise detail in all of his paintings,
mm-hmm.
and people are just really blown away by that, yeah.
Is there a big difference between his original artwork and the prints? I mean, are you able to really pick out differences when you look at original versus prints?
Well, I'd say the big difference, I mean, an original, he painted with acrylic, and so there's
texture. Layered, yeah.
There's texture
right.
there, and that,
right.
I think that's the big difference. We also, he has printed, and we will continue to do so, on both canvas and on paper. And so some of those canvas prints, Kayla was talking the other day,
about how the color can just pop out.
Yeah, there's a big difference between a canvas print and paper print, and it just almost looks almost like an original. But Herb also painted really large, large pieces. Like I think the assembly chambers has one of the tugboat passages just huge on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a lot of paintings on walls.
How do you handle, was he able to sign a lot of the prints before he passed away? How is that kind of being handled?
So we have some signed prints and we have some unsigned prints, and anything that we print from here on out will not be signed.
Kept unsigned.
Well, we'll probably put a digital signature, but then we'll indicate that it's digitally signed and printed posthumously,
right?
So that people will be able to tell the difference between those two.
I think that's good to protect the value of those original prints. And just be transparent about what people are purchasing.
Absolutely,
you know?
Yes.
Because I've seen prints that are, you know, posthumously signed, and they're signed by the estate or something, and it seems a little bit like, what is that exactly, right? So I think that's a really, you know, important direction to go in.
I think transparency is really important, and so as I said, we've also made posters and cards, and we're not calling them prints. They're small. They're not printed through the same printing mechanism that we normally use. But we will be selling the prints. Mm-hmm. It's just that they won't be signed, and we'll be very clear about the fact that they were printed posthumously.
Yeah, and then our gallery, Art Matters, will carry the smaller prints, the larger prints, and then we'll also carry the cards. And then we also do some consignment work at the gallery where people can bring in their Herb Bonnet originals or prints if they were wanting to sell them.
I see.
Yeah.
So has his original artwork been on sale continuously for 40 years, or was there kind of ebbs and flows of when it was available and when it was not being shown in galleries, that kind of thing?
You know, he was the kind of man where he wanted to show at certain galleries, and then sometimes he didn't want to show at certain galleries. Before he passed away, he was very happy showing at Art Matters. So we were happy about that.
Yeah, okay, great. And that's just, it's kind of, you know, when you think about an artist who's had a long career, mm-hmm. you think about different styles they go through, different periods they go through, and different times when, like, their artwork wasn't as available. And then as you look at the legacy of that artist and trying to present mm-hmm. that whole career, that's just a kind of interesting thing to think about. It's, you know, different than when he was alive and active, he just was thinking about what he was doing at the time. And now you're looking back at a whole career and trying to represent this artist in whole, kind of.
Yeah, that's right. And it's actually really interesting because I think that a lot of the boat with the mountains and the skies, there's a lot of consistency across a long period of time mm-hmm. with those paintings. But he also did space paintings with spaceships and planets and things exploding, and he did war paintings. And so he has actually, and he would just kind of, he just loved to paint and he loved to play. And so he did that.
And that makes, then that actually makes me think about another thing, which is that he, any artist, I think, does work that they know is going to be for showing. And then they do they sometimes just do a lot of work that they just are experimenting, they're playing with, or they have an interest in, but they know, well, you know, I'm not going to sell this in Juneau, Alaska. Mm-hmm. This is some other thing, but I really enjoy it. So that's something else that maybe now you get to at least put that up and show it as a representation.
It's actually pretty cool, too, because we have a lot of unfinished originals, and we're selling the unfinished originals at the show as well. And the cool thing about that is you can see the process. And some of them, like there's this one painting of, and it's signed, and it's a plane, but parts of the plane are only sketched in with pencil. So it's sort of like you can see how Herb painted in that painting. It's really
kind of magic in a way, isn't it, to see how artists do that? I'm not an artist, and I'm always just astounded to watch someone just draw a face. Because they start with some area, or they, you know, great artists can have this conceptual thing in their mind already, right? And then it builds out. So that's a fascinating thing. It's a lot of like what Lily Hope was just talking about in weaving. Mm-hmm. Being able to see these Chilkat blankets come together in different stages is fascinating.
Yeah,
right?
It is. And, you see all the layering involved.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, let's go over once again where people can find the work.
So we're at 213 Ferry Way in the bottom of the Marine View on the street front, and we'll be open 4 to 7 today. 10 to 4 tomorrow and 10 to 4 on Sunday. We have a few models that we're doing a silent auction on, and the silent auction will close at 2 on Sunday.
All right, great. Well, it's a kind of a retrospective, maybe the first of many, of the work of Herb Bonnet and Michelle Hale, Herb's daughter, and Kayla Wyatt, owner of the
Art Matters.
Art Matters.
Mm-hmm. Frame Shop and Alaska Art Gallery.
Great. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for coming in, and have a great show.
Thanks so
much.
Sounds
like a lot
you.
Of fun to see that whole retrospective of all of his work.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Thanks.
This gallery walk, see new perspectives, the KTOO staff and volunteer photography show up through the month of December. Between our producers, reporters, photographers, administrators, volunteer DJs, and engineers, we public media people love to take pictures. Join us for a first Friday Gallery Walk reception at 4 p.m. on December 1st and share our professional and personal perspectives of the world.
And right, I heard a dark voice beside of me, and I looked round in a state of fright. I saw four faces, one mad, a brother from the gutter. They looked me up and down a bit and turned to each other.
Back to a Juno afternoon. Andy Klein with you here in the studio, being joined by a bunch of museum type folks. Right? Is that pretty good? We should just call it. Okay. So we have some curators here. First off, we've got Addison Field, who's the chief curator over at the APK at the Alaska State Museum.
Good to be here again.
Yeah, good to see you as well. Thanks for coming in. And with me also joining us is India Young and Suzanne Frick. And they're the co-curators of a new exhibit at the APK building called As We See It. So I'll just ask you first, Suzanne, tell me a little bit about that that exhibit.
Well, thanks for having us here. As We See It is an exhibition of contemporary photography by living Native American artists. It started in 2014 when the curator of the Novosibirsk State Museum of Art asked if we would put together a selection of photography by living photographers, Native American photographers, for the Biennale, which was called Different Dimensions. And that's when I asked India Young if she would join me, and together we put together a group of artists that we hoped would suggest the depth and range in techniques and skill. And across North America, there are so many great photographers. And there's really a long history of photography among the Native Americans, dating back to the mid-20th century.
And that's an interesting thing to think about, because when I think of Native American art, I think of artwork created by Native Americans, but not in the photographic field. So That's a. How was that the thing that became what was decided on to kind of exhibit and talk about? And what are some of the considerations when you're trying to make sure you're bringing in those perspectives?
Well, can I just bring in two things? One is here in the United States, but also in Russia, there is this sense of Native American art containing the idea of photographs by people like Edward Curtis and Timothy O'Sullivan. But we should remember, too, that there were a number of very successful Native American photographers from the 20th century. Horace Pulaff, who just had a great show of his work at the National Museum of the American Indian. That was organized by Nancy Marie Mythlow and Tom Jones. And Lee Marmon also did a lot of photography. So there is a long legacy of Native Americans doing photography.
And there are a couple legacies that relate to the Northwest Coast as well. Winter and Pond were some very famous photographers here in the region. Mm-hmm. And one of their assistants was a Tlingit fellow. And in the very, very well-known film done by Edward Curtis, when he titled it, it was called In the Land of the Headhunters. That film was made with the Kwakwaka'wakw community of British Columbia, and that community really had a lot of input and say over how that the filming went and the art that was made in that film. So here in the Pacific Northwest, there is another long history of Indigenous community members really using photography as a medium to demonstrate their visibility in everyday life.
Was it something, did photography for Native Americans, especially earlier in the 20th century, was it something that, was there a certain amount of accessibility to the equipment, to being able to create that allowed it to be, sort of more accessible, more something more accepted for them to be able to do?
Yeah, I think photography is one of those wonderful mediums that we all get to relate to because it is accessible. We can think back to the snapshot when Kodak made cameras that we could all reach out to. And one of the artists in our show, Beverly Singer, has been a photographer and a filmmaker for the last 35, 40 years, and she was one of the very early video artists who picked up a camcorder and started and participated in the early era of video art in the 70s and 80s, and we've got a great piece by her that kicks off the show.
Yeah, and that's presented in a video format?
Yeah.
So what are some of the challenges in doing that? I mean, that's different than hanging a photograph on the wall, right? So...
Those are just technical exhibition challenges.
Okay.
Right, and
Madison,
we've got an absolutely
that.
Spectacular exhibits team in the facility now to do that sort of thing. You know, a couple of years ago, that would have been much harder than it is now in the new APK. But, you know, since we got the new show, the new galleries, the new building, it's just much easier for us to accommodate artists who are working in those sort of mediums. And, we were super excited when we started this conversation about bringing this exhibit in because it really deals with a lot of, or really gives more exposure to a lot of the themes that we hope we're talking about in our permanent exhibits and in our temporary exhibit program and gives a platform for Alaska Native artists to show their work.
So how do you make the decision on who you're going to show? I mean,
well,
there are a lot of different
factors. I think one important factor was showing diversity. I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and it's very easy to do the all Diné show all the time because there's a lot of it around and a lot available. But we wanted to show a range in media. We have a range in ages. We have photographers who are in their mid-20s up to more than their 20s, let's say.
sure.
We wanted to show there's digital photography, analog or film photography, video. One artist, Tom Jones, who is a professor at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, uses scanning technology to create his digital images. And it turns out with a very interesting field of focus. They turn out wonderfully. He takes toy plastic trees, like the kind you get with your little green army men and the little Indian figures that you get from the toy store. He puts them on a scanner, gets a high-resolution image, and then blows it up really big. And I want to applaud the museum for hanging it in such a spectacular way so that we get these rich blacks with these beautiful colors. They're all in a grid, and it just really looks stunning.
That piece actually stopped me in my tracks the first time I saw it fully installed. And I had to sit and think about it for a while, and that's exactly what we want.
And his work is so layered. So you look at it, and it does make you think, okay, it's a tree, it's something natural. But it's not. It's a toy. It's plastic. So you get this idea of something that is, but it isn't. And then there's a whole other layer to it, the titles of the pieces, like Maricopa Landscape, Seminole Landscape. They reference one of the most important early 20th century collections of photography by Edward Curtis, his North American Indians book, which took him over a decade to create. And it's called, the North American Indian. In this case, Tom called it the North American Landscape. So each of these plastic toys, each of these images, which is so tiny but big and fake but real, they represent a specific place in the world, and it just sends you into the spiral of how do we know what we know? What's real? What's fake?
Was there a consideration about history? Did you want to try to create a sense of the entire, a taste of the entirety of the history of Native Americans using photography as an art form?
So the photography that we've chosen is all contemporary photography and all living artists. Most of these artists' works do reference long histories of their communities, of their communities' relationships to photography by people like Curtis. But all of the work is current work.
And does it all reflect a Native lifestyle?
That's a very interesting question. There is no
That's true.
Native
There's no
lifestyle.
Native lifestyle, but I guess I'm trying to say that maybe the unique parts of Native culture, being a Native American, and the unique parts of being a Native American, do you feel that all of it reflects that?
It certainly reflects a worldview that comes from an indigenous place. Each of the artists are coming from their own specifically indigenous place, and as Susan said, these artists are Mohawk,
Where's Tom Jones from? Tlingits.
Ho-Chunk. Dene. So they are reflecting their own community's experiences and their own specific experiences, but I wouldn't say that there is an overall sense that this is, that you can know what, quote,
mm-hmm.
Native is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in the work of Will Wilson, he created his Contemporary Indigenous Photographic Exchange, or CIPEX. It's an ongoing series since 2012. When we talked about it, he mentioned going to a photography store, and he saw a tintype kit. And he was just intrigued, like, oh, wow, you can just buy a kit and make a tintype. So he did, and he loved it. And it made him think about the history of photography. And now he works with an 80-year-old camera, and he creates a tintype. He invites sitters to come. He makes a tintype of them. And then he gifts the tintype to the sitter, and the sitter gifts a digital copy of the image to him, which he then prints very large. We have a selection of these portraits. And that act of creating an exchange, it creates a cycle that he was thinking about these photographers going out to Native communities in the late 19th, early 20th century, taking images, and not necessarily leaving anything, not making things better. And he wanted to create more of a cycle. He asked the sitters how they wanted to be portrayed, what they wanted to be portrayed with. So in the selection we have here, we have Joe Horsecapture, who is a curator, and he was at the National Museum of the American Indian, the Minneapolis Museum of Art. He is shown holding an iPad, on which he calls up a Curtis photograph of his ancestor, who is also named Horsecapture. So we have Joe Horsecapture, who is a curator, a person who works with images. He describes it as being a warrior with images. And he shows his ancestor, who's holding a rifle, holding his instrument of being a warrior. And this wonderful coming together of the sitter and the photographer, and then that exchange is really what that whole series is about.
Mm. Well, it's called As I See It. It's an exhibit happening over at the APK. What are some of the details for folks who want to see it?
Well, As We See It will be open grand opening tonight and be here through March. We are open for gallery walk tonight, 4:30 to 7, so we'll have free admission. There's a lot going on in the building tonight. Ricky Tagaban and Kay Parker will be there with some of their contemporary art that's going on in the gift shop. There are also two solo exhibits currently running, a solo exhibit by Daniel Papke, who's a painter from Skagway, and another by Annette Bellamy, who is, she works in ceramics and works with fish skin as well from Halibut Cove.
Well, great. Yeah.
So come on in, get your annual pass. Hopefully we'll see you tonight.
Sounds great. Addison Field from the State Museum, also India Young and Suzanne Frick, thanks so much for telling us a little bit about the As We See It exhibit.
Thank you.
Have a great show.